This was her country now. Atlantis was more than a mirage at times. The memories dimmer as the present molded her mind, bringing her closer to the law of one, the law of the Lord, which never changed, whatever the time or place. For one place was so much like another as the world became one, both heaven and earth, even unto the sun and moon that ruled this small part of his universe. There was no end to the spirit the Lord had given her. That, she knew, was immortal. It was like the wind, which blew of a storm that became still, to return as the Lord willed, as fresh and renewed as before. The world never became so great she couldn't embrace it, for as she loved others, she loved her Creator. For meditation to heal the earth, I fill my heart with love and visualize a pyramid surrounding the earth, cleansing it from all pollution, all fear, all suffering. I imagine this pyramid sending healing energy to the earth and to its inhabitants as I think of all the energy centers in our land, east, west, north, south, and those abroad in Europe, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, where the sun once sojourned. She saw the people absorbing the earth's vibrations and pulsating with light, influencing all sides of the triangle, which represent the Holy Spirit, the Trinity in man. She wondered how God meant so many different things to people, even in Atlantis, where some still believed while others joined with Belial like the spoiled children they were. How else could she think of these forebears, hoping they may have had their lesson and mounted new lives, where the dimmed past was remembered only in his light? For Verna, God was not harnessed to any specific creed. He was everywhere. He belonged not to everyone, but with everyone. A friend of Verna's wondered how she could believe in God when she no longer went to church. It was something to consider, since so many she knew were avid churchgoers and lived by God's word. But for Verna, God was universal. In the wind and the seas, in the skies and forests, in the hearts of man, and yes, the animals, for they too were his creations. How could she answer this? With tact and diplomacy, or the directness that had become part of her nature as her love for the Lord blossomed? She responded as gently as she could and still say what was in her heart. "I absolutely believe in God," she told her friend. "I just don't believe in the bureaucracies that exist in his name." The friend was only partially appeased. "Well," she said, "you believe in your God, I'm sure." Verna caught the sharpness in the other woman's voice. "There is one God," she said evenly, "and no matter what we call ourselves, we can all be on different paths to him." The friend turned away. The answer had not satisfied her. Her God did not recognize any other God. Verna thought about it. She was sophisticated enough to realize that God could be, and should be, all things to all people. And yet the denial of this was the cause of so much hostility and anger in the world. The last thing her God would want. She remembered Edgar Cayce saying that divisions over religion had been a factor in more confrontations and wars than anything. And now, on the eve of the millennium, with so many expectant of Christ's resurrection, how could there be any divisions when all he counseled was that man should love and help each other? It was not the religion that was wrong-minded, not the church, for that was only a mindless building, a place of worship, to be sure, but no more sanctified than the beautiful skies and mountains the Lord had created. It was the people whose minds were closed to the hearts of those who felt differently. Nothing seemed to have changed in thousands of years. "It is separatist thinking like hers," Verna thought, "that is the root of our world's problems today. We define each other by color, gender, and occupation. Yet, regardless of the differences, there is something inside us that is the same, that makes us all one, and that is God. If some of us were in Atlantis during the great upheavals and are now given another chance to heal ourselves and the Earth, perhaps it is a blessing that we are not as technically advanced as we were in Atlantis. She went on to quote a woman who had spoken much about the power of love. Author Marianne Williamson says that if we don't heed these warnings and mend our ways, our children will invent something much worse than the nuclear bomb. And sooner than this, we may have to contend with the predicted pole shift. Verna was not concerned about what havoc might be wrought by a polar shift, which last occurred tens of thousands of years ago, according to some scientists. The shift, affecting the Earth's magnetic field, they said, had taken place 700,000 years ago and wasn't slated for a complete reversal for thousands of years. As Verna knew so well, being an ardent believer in the wisdom of Edgar Cayce, a rise in the human consciousness, a renewal of faith in the brotherhood of man, could blot out some spots that affected the Earth's magnetic field, with a resulting influence adversely on the Earth's polar axis. It was all very complex unless you were a scientist, and they only seemed to make it more complex, differing from each other even as the Earth kept wobbling along on its axis, headed for whatever future the universal mind, the Creator, had in store for the children he had spawned. Verna had no misgivings about the future. She fell back on what Edgar Cayce had said about a bright new millennium emerging in a world where positive thoughts could affect the ruling sun and companion planets. While Jeff Stern wasn't that sure of this, he was sure that despite all the scientists and scribes straining to get out their dire predictions, Cayce was correct in his assumption that the shifting of the pole would be a gradual process that even the gloomiest scientists would survive. Verna saw the positive side. Edgar Cayce said that people of superior knowledge and abilities caused their own destruction by their greed for power and misuse of those abilities to intimidate and prey on those weaker than themselves. Thousands of years later, we are fighting the same karmic battles and potentially face the same end that we did in Atlantis. I believe we have time to cancel our karmic debt and the ability to shift our perceptions. A shift of the material plans will not be necessary. It will take a lot of love and a lot of healing, starting with each of us. On a larger scale, many people are praying every day to raise their vibrations enough to spare us the severe lessons of Atlantis. If enough of us believe that this is possible and we work very hard together, we can truly unite to build a better place for those souls who will come after us. I plan to be here when wars will only be something to read about in history books, when people will have to look up words like incest, gangs, terrorism, and prejudice, because no one but a few aged people, like me by that time, will know what they mean. The souls that come after us will be unwilling to believe that we once viewed our brothers and sisters as different and separate from us, simply because of their looks or beliefs. I dream of what life will be like in this future world that we do have the power to create. I hope to see you there. Edgar Cayce said that it is a privilege to incarnate and have another chance to live the right way. We must remember this and be mindful of our every word and thought. There will still be suffering and pain for some, but it is our duty to help them always. We might not be able to be there physically, and we may not be able to donate our time or be able to offer monetary contributions, but we are always able and can always afford to send our love, to remember them in our prayers, and to send them healing light for their recovery. It was a utopian world that Verna Austin was visualizing. But it was no more than Edgar Cayce had foreshadowed with the millennium, if mankind chose to escape the lessons of a subcontinent that may have disappeared with the biblical flood, leading to the dispersal of survivors to Egypt, Asia Minor, and the Caribbean Sea, namely Mexico, Central America, and South America. Verna had a number of regressions that took her back to her prehistoric home. They gave her greater insight into a present life, the only one Cayce says we could live now, and to her visions of the past. In her regressions, without Atlantis being mentioned, she saw beautiful shining towers, sparkling beaches with white sand and glittering palaces made entirely of crystal. I saw many white obelisks whose pyramid tops were made of crystals. It felt like Egypt, but the land was much too lush and green. It could only be one place, Atlantis. I could hardly believe my eyes. My heart leapt at the sight of my ancient home. I longed to stay, but it wasn't to be. The vision of Atlantis stayed and grew. She didn't talk about it, not for fear of being ridiculed, but of a memory that was very private and painful. A memory of being molested as a child, which had taken her to the hypotherapist's couch. "I know," she said, "that many people of the New Age, with its sophisticated thinking, believe that we choose to be abused. That before we incarnate, we know exactly what will happen to us in every lifetime, and that by choosing such painful experiences, we will advance faster spiritually." "This," she emphasized, "is not true. We may know that we have a history with a certain soul, and we may know things that have happened in past lives, but there is no rule that says it will happen again. Because we have free will, we choose what we learn and what we teach. By choosing the role of a sex abuser and then repeating it, the hardened abuser then tries to fill the emptiness he feels within with alcohol and drugs and by hurting others. But there can never be enough of these escapes to fill the empty places inside of him, because only God can relieve these dark places. The ordeal she had experienced, in a present reality and an Atlantis recollection, had turned her to a God she had communed with from childhood. He was very real, helping when no one else could have helped. Only God can give us the peace we try to attain with food, money, alcohol, and drugs. They are not the basic problems, but plainly symptoms. Somehow we know we are not living up to our potential, fulfilling the mission God sent us here to accomplish. We have a part to play in healing the world, something that can only be done by us. Before we are able to do this, we must settle our unresolved issues from the past, whether from 5 years ago or 5,000 years. We need to heal our past before we can create our future. As a librarian, she relates some of her present life to what she did in Atlantis. The library and the Temple of One are similar places. Both occupations have to do with helping people find what they are looking for. They are both places that help to spread information. In whatever job we work at, it is important to see the people with whom we come into contact as fellow human beings, fellow travelers on the path. It is a shame that we tend to see our lives in terms of events that we participate in, someone's wedding, a party, a new job, instead of really connecting on a soul level with each other. How many times do we really mean it when we ask someone how they are? When we view our lives as events instead of as moments that we have with each other, we fail to see the unlimited human potential that is within every one of us. Once I overheard a conversation between two people. One person said, "Oh, heck, it's Monday again. I hate Mondays." The other replied, "Isn't it great? I love every day." I try to adopt this attitude. It doesn't really matter how the weather is, what time it is, what's going on this evening. What matters is that our lives are made up of perfect moments, unlimited opportunities to connect with each other's lives. That was the profession of those of us who worked in the Temple of One, people sharing their light with others. We can still do this today, in whatever job we have. Verna had the nagging notion that she was not doing all she could do to help the world get in stride with the Lord or heal the wounds of childhood. So she went to the therapist's couch again and turned up another episode in her Atlantean experience. She had known her sexual abuser then. She was one of the keepers of the way, the spiritual caretakers whose job it was to oversee the healing in the Temple of One. We were also responsible for the great crystal and making sure it was only used to further our highest ideas. This immensely powerful crystal acted as a giant battery and, combined with the rays of the sun, could provide the energy transporting ships over the land and through the air, moving large objects and aiding in the construction of temples and great homes. The possibilities, as she saw, were endless. Corresponding with Casey's description of research leading up to the death ray, and with laser surgery and healings with beams of colored light, she was chosen as the head keeper of the temple, eventually, overseeing other keepers, one being the man who had abused her on the Earth and in Atlantis. He was dead set against her and was forcibly removed. She sensed his hatred as he swore eternal revenge. With this came her realization that sexual abuse was not about sex at all, but about the theft of power, the desire, or lust, to control. For the first time, she realized she had been trapped all her life in her own fears of molestation, of the torment of feeling soiled and impure. I thought and prayed long and hard for weeks. I no longer believed I had been born bad. I knew that somewhere inside me, the tiny spark of God had enabled me to survive. I would no longer need to look outside myself, or God, for guidance. I would no longer trim my life to what others thought. I would no longer call myself a survivor, because it would imply I had been a victim. I was victimized, yes, but only I could call myself a victim, but no longer. Let others think as they would. I was inspired by the story of Anne Frank, who, in spite of the misery and horrible oppression she experienced, was able to rise above her ordeal, to believe that people really are good at heart. Anne Frank, in her concentration camp, was able to see beyond the horrors and the pain and the fear, to a place with God where we are all one. This was the law that the children of the Law of One followed in Atlantis, before they were overcome by their false pride and idle thoughts of grandeur, taking them from the one to whom they owed their everything. And then came the earthquakes and the storms and the flood. And then it was too late. A keeper like myself had little authority with the sons of Belial, the apostles of the devil, who ruled. But not for long, for God ruled differently. I well remember the time. Many of us Atlanteans now fear the storms and earthquakes and other aberrations of nature that preceded the earth changes. Some even have memories of the earth falling through the sky. Edgar Casey tells us that the destruction of Atlantis in 28,000 BC coincided with the biblical story of Noah and the flood. Noah, whose name in Aramaic means one who will comfort the world, was truly a hero, a man who lived by his faith when all around him people were lost in despair. During the time in which he lived, the earth people did not live by God's law. Materialism and self-seeking concerns were the only laws of the land. God grew impatient waiting for people to change their ways. Eventually, he decided to send a message that could not be ignored. Behold, I will bring a great flood of waters, and every living thing on earth shall die. People were warned that the destruction could be averted, but they didn't listen. Then God commanded Noah, who honored the Lord, to build the ark that he and his family would not die. His neighbors scoffed. The destruction of Atlantis was their own doing. In their quest to rule the world, they misused the tools they had invented for healing and spiritual knowledge, using them to exert control over all living things on earth. Edgar Casey tells us that the final destruction came about when the great crystal, cared for so lovingly in the Temple of One and used only for the greatest good, was instead turned into a death ray, whose energies were pressed onto the earth as an atomic-like weapon. It was believed that these killing rays would travel through the earth and destroy everything in their path. thus establishing Atlantis's dominion on the Earth. While this was happening, there was much preparation behind the scenes. The children of the Law of One had been warned and were preparing the way for those who would come after them. They hid their records and traveled to distant lands to give warnings. They did not colonize these lands, but came instead from a love for all of humanity. They were forced to destroy what they could not transport, most notably the crystal skulls of Atlantis. Verna recalled her stated role with the Keepers of the Way. Because these crystal skulls were encoded with such power from the healings in which they were used, it became necessary to destroy most of them to keep them from falling into the hands of the Sons of Belial. Many refused, believing it was blasphemy. But gradually they saw that it was a test. Did we not know that the power to heal lies within? We used these crystals only as helpers, as symbols of our power. The few skulls that were saved were hidden. A time will come when they will be gathered up, signaling that the new age has finally arrived. As the Atlanteans were given ample warning and time to prepare, so are we. It is not too late. We still can join our brother, whatever his country, whatever his skin color, whatever his name for God. We will finally see that we are more alike than we are different. The children of the Law of One prepared the way for us, having the foresight to see there would come a time when all over the earth people would need to stand hand in hand and call out the word. That word is brother. Chapter 9. The Seekers. Doug Richards was an amiable, good-looking man, looking more Hollywood than a professor, bouncing around more like an athlete than an explorer looking for an island empire that had died 10,000 years ago, and being very eloquent. As far as I'm concerned, Atlantis is very real. I can picture it as Edgar Cayce visualized it, in all its grandeur and then its fall. I can see where we have a lot to learn from what Cayce said. I'm not a professional geologist or oceanographer, which may be a help since I'm not married to any of the fixed concepts that have failed to turn up about Atlantis. There has been some evidence of its past, but nothing that's tangible. Not after thousands of years with all that shifting sediment on the floor of the ocean around the Bahamas. Edgar Cayce gave us the boundaries, the spur, and we're shooting for the millennium, the new age. He pondered for a moment. Everybody wants the gold idol that proves they got Atlantis. Yet it seems to me that the search may be even more important than the discovery. For more and more, in searching, you get an idea there's some connection between us and them. They have a lot to tell us. To get wherever we're going helps to know where we came from. The popular idea today is of gradual progress from a caveman with a club in his hand to a wonderful civilization. And then it can't help but get better. There are others who think it's all due for a big crash and we'll never recover. But looking at what Cayce said, you can see a cyclical sort of thing. Where the Atlanteans had a high culture, made some mistakes, and crashed. We seem to be on the same edge now, riding the crest, with lots of greed and lust for power. If we find the remnants of Atlantis, I think it could be the greatest thing in the world for the world, especially the people who laugh at the thought of a lost continent. For then we'll find a lot of people changing their tune and saying, we better get our act together, or we're going to end up the same way. Jess Stern was somewhat more optimistic about this, having Cayce's assurance that the approaching millennium was going to be essentially positive. Apart from whether Atlantis was a myth or a harsh learning reality. Richards was saying what other explorers were saying. But Jess Stern had a feeling it would take a lot of doing by people who thought like Richards to change the prevalent view that Atlantis was a myth. He shook his head. It's not a myth as long as we learn from the stories that have come down about them, beginning with Plato, then on to where Cayce made it all come alive. You have to ask yourself, If he was so right about so many things, why can't he be right about a lost continent, where he describes the people and the land with such vivid detail that you can just sense the overwhelming pride and selfishness that brought them down? He spoke with such vigor and enthusiasm that the author asked, "What is personally driving you?" "Well, I have a sense of the metaphysical, which brought me to the Casey readings, having worked for a couple of years with Dr. Joseph B. Rhine, the psychic researcher, in his laboratory at Duke University. That opened the doors of consciousness for me, but it didn't have the excitement of getting out where the action was and grappling with reality. There's a sense of history, something exciting to do, deep diving, studying the geology, as opposed to sitting in an office or lab. For the higher purpose, there's a feeling of transforming things in terms of what our civilization thinks of itself. If you come on something tangible, something that could snap of Atlantis, people will take it and run with it. So ultimately, there can be a greater awareness of our potential for destroying ourselves again or being constructive." Jess Stern had an idea that the Casey readings had a lot to do with getting him involved. Dr. Rhine nodded. "There's a Casey reading where Casey suggests that a committee could be set up to dig into all the stuff that had to do with his readings. He was that sure. There are lots of people working on it today because of him. Where there's anything that helps people address their spiritual side, Casey says go for it. Looking for Atlantis isn't going to make any of us any money. Somebody may have a big Atlantis resort there on Bimini, but it won't be me. A lot of the problems with the Atlantis research is that Casey emphasized that you have to work like thunder, and with the exception of a handful of divers, almost everybody who's come down looking for Atlantis spends a week in Bimini, takes a few pictures, goes on a dive trip, takes a look at a few old rocks that look like paving stones, and then calls the National Enquirer and says they found Atlantis. What we need to get is some professional divers, go deeper, and then set up our paraphernalia on the edge of the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream current washes away the sediments, so you have bare rock to determine whether it's a natural formation or man-made, hopefully Atlantean. There are other good diving spots mentioned by Casey, but they're hard to find in trackless water. The author thought of the effort going into all this searching for something that could very well be no more than a dream. Dr. Rhine had no trouble reading Stern's mind. It takes somebody with some maverick tendencies to be willing to do it. And you have to convince yourself that in the end you'll discover something that will benefit mankind. Your mind has to be open, but not so open that your brains fall out. So far it all ends up in a lot of hard work. Then I fall back on the Casey readings. And I realize that we in general, and me in particular, need that extra spiritual dimension in life to make sense of it. So what I got out of the Casey readings was a sense of how to find the meaning of what we're doing and keep feeling at one with everyone that's working at it like we are. I've seen a lot of people go off the deep end with Atlantis and do nasty things to each other. In fact, this is fairly standard. It's standard in archaeology and life in general. And that's where the Casey spiritual measure helps. It would be nice to feel real good, even if Atlantis wasn't there, and either Casey was wrong or we were wrong in the way we went about it. Meanwhile, we learned a lot about ourselves, and a lot of everything we were about. With all the reverses, there's still a way to have some personal growth. Instead of what you so often see everywhere else, people so busy stabbing somebody in the back so they can get rich and famous, so that they lose track of why they're here in the first place. Except as examples of how so many got in the Atlantis, Casey visualized before its destruction. Casey wasn't a prophet whose prophecies were written in stone. He frequently told people they could change what he saw with the free will God had given them, and discouraged them from living by whatever he told them, and not following their own soul. But not with Atlantis. He never changed his belief in the Atlantis he saw, for it was his way of warning people everywhere of dangers of our reliving the Atlantean experience with the same disastrous result. He never joked about Atlantis, as he did some predictions he dealt with. One man came to him saying, "Is the prediction true that I will die suddenly at the age of 80 in Tibet?" And Casey would say, "Well, if you live to be 80 and you visit Tibet, it's possible you'll die there." Richards was still betting on Casey. He was right on target with his geology. When Casey talked about where you could find significant things in the Bahamas, minerals and things, he said you have to go down to 12 to 15 foot levels under the current Bimini surface. It turns out, when they were dredging the channel, they dug up a piece of mangrove peat, organic material, 9 feet below a surface that dated back 9,000 years. So with the 12,000 years back that Casey was talking about, it was even deeper. So when you see the current island of Bimini, none of that was visible in the time frame Casey gave. It was completely awash. So if this was the Atlantis Casey was talking about, it was rising as he said it would. Richards was so dedicated, the author found himself hoping that he would come on Atlantis long before his hair and teeth fell out. Do you still have as strong a desire as when you started off so hopefully years ago? Absolutely. Whatever I find or don't find, my major driving force is still the same: to find where we came from and why we're here. When we find enough to know there was an Atlantis, then we can determine pretty well that everything else Casey said about the island, with all its grandeur and decay, was true. Stern muddled over it a little. And so we find an Atlantis. How does that bring us closer to a solution of why and how we're now on an Earth that Casey says will be in pretty good shape for quite a time? Richard's brow knit for a moment. I don't know if it brings us closer in an easy way. You can't deny that things are very complex in terms of where we came from, even when we find Atlantis. But you have many interpretations of what it means. My feeling is that at the point where we find something's really there, we're going to have all kinds of ideas about what we're about and what it means for our future. He smiled. And whatever they are, if it gets everybody thinking, that's something in itself. Richards had a partner in his search for the future. She was, improbably, a former high school principal with a passionate interest in the nature of God and man in the life experience we share. If you are a Hollywood producer and casting for a movie, a middle-aged Joan Handley might be the last person you would choose to be the adventurer who put her conventional past behind her to begin a passionate search for a lost continent that has titillated the world's most venturesome explorers for centuries. She doesn't claim to be an expert. She leaves that to the geologists and underwater divers who have been navigating the waters around Bimini for decades, without anything more exciting to show for it than a few paving stones and some mangrove peat. She was challenged early on when a geologist, who had never been on Bimini, told her not to waste her time. All the stones the other geologists found were no more than beach rock. As they were scientists and she was a high school principal, she might as well stop right there. Joan Handley laughed and decided that being a principal was a much more difficult job than being a geologist. Anyway, that kind of geologist. From his easy chair, he proclaimed. She had the right qualities: endurance and perseverance. Being a high school principal in Miami could be demanding, but it was never dull. She was a disciplinarian when she had to be, for she liked effort, the kind of effort that was getting her entangled with trials and mysteries of so many lost millenniums. As a high school principal, I didn't like to apply corporal punishment, although I confess I did a few times. On my favorite kids, usually, as I saw they had a little more than some and could reach for their personal moons with some discipline and encouragement. She had lost a child, and that had caused her to re-examine her life and what she would do for the years ahead. I really needed a passion to keep me going. My passion for my family was diverted into this search. I had been fascinated with the Lost Empire before I heard of Edgar Casey. So many became involved by his descriptions of Atlantis. But with myself, I think there was a built-in readiness for the search. It was a case of wanting to know where we were in the time frame so we could have an idea where we were going. That's the underlying thought. I've always been curious, even as a tiny girl, asking those why questions. And I really haven't got many answers. But I guess you just keep plugging away. She looked up with a smile. How about you? You've been writing your entire life. Haven't you been searching? Well, the author thought a moment. My grandmother would always say, God is everything, and we kids would say, riveted by the eternal puzzle, who put God there? And she'd say, His will is supreme. The author eventually decided he was always there, and that was why he was God. With the new millennium approaching, Handley, now a Casey fan, has the feeling that Casey's expectations of an Atlantis ultimately rising may be in sight. She believes that his predicted spiritual renaissance may be yet the most significant outcome of the tenacious search for an island empire that disappeared overnight, particularly since Casey says its life could very well be a preview of our own. As Handley points out, her search, like so many, goes beyond the physical dimensions of Atlantis or any other land. The end of the old age is coming, she says. And with the new Aquarian age, people are getting focused on the bettering of our society. I have the feeling we're right on schedule. It seems as though energy comes at the right time if we hold the ideal and monitor our motives. She feels Atlantean searchers should have a sense of balance about what they're doing. She's seen people go haywire if they thought they found something like a man-made paving stone in deep water when it might have been a slab of beach rock, like the one her geologist advisor knew was beach rock before he saw it. It's more about tracing a civilization than it is about rocks and stones. Our quest appears so much more difficult than Egypt or South America, the Incas. But Atlantis was far grander than either of those ancient civilizations. The migrating Atlanteans, profiting by their own experience, didn't want their technological expertise to perpetuate itself. They wanted a clean start. It was a little fanciful, trying to impose the minds of a culture that may never have existed. But the Russians and other explorers have found enough on or near the mid-Atlantic ridge to indicate some subterranean land body. And there are millions everywhere clinging to the hope of an Atlantis that was a far better example for us before it disintegrated from a loss of spirit and defiance of the Lord. The educator in Joan Handley was constantly peering behind the curtain of time for a deeper reason for a search taking so much of the searcher's energy and substance. Our guest is giving us something back, something larger than money and attention. I think there's a lot of thought that the gritty problems the world is facing now are not going to be solved because people won't deal with it. This was something Casey was saying right along. But if man is able to join in a global cause of survival, I believe that would prove that we have a greater potential for cooperation than we realize. Giving reality to the downfall of Atlantis, as Casey has done, gives us some idea of what could happen to us. For as Atlantis became divided, with their people estranged, it was inevitable they would destroy themselves. I think more and more people will come to believe this is a possibility, that the cooperative society can get us into the future better than the competitive society that we have come to automatically believe in. We need more tolerance for each other, our religious beliefs, even our faults. With it all, even if Atlantis were a myth, which I don't believe, we have a lesson in survival here, a greater and more vivid example as the myth magically becomes reality through man's delving into his past. Like other searches for man's identity, the Atlantean adventure plumbs deep into the hearts of people of every persuasion, nearly all with something very direct and intriguing in their outlook. And that is mystery. I like the word mystery attached to Atlantis, says Mark Thurston, a top psychologist and authority on the Casey story. The deepest sense of mystery. Not just a Sherlock Holmes kind of mystery, but mystery with a capital M. For something in us knows, intuitively, there's got to be more to a story about human nature than the history books say. They speak so often of the activities of men who with faith in the Creator can move mountains. So let us probe further. The fascination I have with Atlantis is that it reveals a human history that goes back farther than the typical history book says. It also says to me that human history isn't just a steady progress upward. It's like a roller coaster. We've had peaks and then valleys. When we realize that progress isn't always certain because of free will, we see how we can make mistakes and send humanity into a tailspin. It puts much more responsibility back on us. You're saying we, the whole collective human family. When I first read about Atlantis, what was intriguing to me was this highly technological world that still had some connection with the spirit. There were these children of the Law of One who still remembered their connection with the Creator. Then these other groups or souls, sons of Belial. And with it, there was a polarization of good and evil. Whereas in today's world, the distinction is often murky. It's harder to see what's helping or hurting humanity. Sometimes, even when it's obvious what helps and what hurts, there's still a gray area. In the Atlantis story, it's very clear that some souls were committed to oneness and some to selfishness. In the 1930s and the 1940s, with a worldwide depression and a worldwide war, it was very clear once again, with the villains pretty well defined, as they were in Atlantis, greed and the lust for power. In the 90s, approaching the millennium, it's harder to get a handle on what's helping and hurting humanity. The Atlantis story states so graphically what Hugh Lynn Casey, Edgar's son, used to say, emulating his father. With every deed and thought, we're building up or tearing down. The Atlantis story makes that point very clearly. The deeds are the fathers of a thought. I've been intrigued with how Casey describes the Atlanteans as a thought people, given a psychic connection with their world, and more of a connection with the human family. What Casey had to say about Atlantis had a snowball effect, more than some history books or earthquakes. I remember this one educator taking in the Casey World Affairs readings with their allusions to Atlantis and asking, "What do those readings teach us about the 21st century? The millennial century, we're just a few hops and skips from." The conclusion was that unless we built a new world order based on oneness, with the interconnection of all human life, we're going down the tube. But if we have this oneness that Casey spoke of, which Atlantis lack, there's going to be a positive change. The author thought of the troublesome disharmonies in our society today. Does that exclude differences and distinctions in race, religion, nationality, gender? I don't think these distinctions are going to go away, but we'll be able to see beyond to the underlying oneness. I think there's still going to be different nations and languages. He laughed. And different genders, I trust. But can we see through all that to the oneness? He thought of the violence of the day and the festering wars. It isn't just the killing. It's millions of people sitting in front of the TV set in an alpha, higher consciousness, state, concentrating on the news, enlarging its reality. And so where does it all stop? You've mentioned that Casey so often stressed that man, in a large sense, has the power to change his life and environment by his thought and spirituality. Thurston nodded. That's really what a prophet is supposed to do. He's supposed to give a warning and address what can be done to change things. Broadly speaking, I think we're hoping to find evidence that humanity has to rethink its future. If we rethink our past, it makes sense that we're going to rethink our future. The principle that we tend to repeat our history suggests that once we open up and see our history in a different way, then we may see we've got to make some very important and difficult choices. If it's no more than a myth, it still may give new and positive dimensions to our lives. Without arguing whether Atlantis existed or not, or whether some of it is allegorical, it still gives some meaning to the human condition. It says things like we are responsible with our God-given free will with which we create our future. The Atlantis story, its rise and fall, emphasizes how just having great powers of the mind and of the spirit does not ensure our happiness. There's always the danger we may misuse those extraordinary expanded capabilities we are now expressing in communication, which is why it's so relevant to this millennium shift that we're moving into a realm where the powers of the mind are more and more evident. The Atlantis story is saying that the revelation of Atlantis could be a great boon for humanity, but only if we see the mistakes as well as the glory. But as Edgar Cayce said, we have a choice. We are, God willing, the masters of our destiny, and, as the poet said, the captains of our fate. Chapter 10, God's Book. Edgar Cayce was a firm believer in the Bible. It was God's word through his prophets, and God didn't speak lightly, nor say anything he couldn't make good on. One of the Lord's statements that Cayce mentioned so often had something to do with a handful of God-loving people standing their ground against the hazards of life, whether they were the forces of evil or the furies of the elements. 1 or 10 men, said Cayce, from the good book, can make a difference if they hold on with faith in the Lord. They didn't have to be a big hero like Lord Nelson or General Patton, but the so-called little man, humble and unsung, showing fortitude and leadership as they dared the smoking volcano with the Aztec name of Popocatépetl, fondly known as Popo, from doing his worst. Old Popo, some 18,000 feet tall, does its erupting in the heart of Mexico, some 50 miles from the throbbing metropolis of Mexico City, which looks over its shoulder from time to time to make sure old smoky Popo is still behaving. Our friendly neighbor to the south has had a few bad shots recently with El Niño, blasting the resort city of Acapulco, causing a tragic loss of life and property. The nearby tragedy of their countrymen has left the people dwelling at the base of the volcanic mountain sympathetic, but unafraid as they go about their daily routine of tilling their fields in and around the village of San Pedro, sending their children to church, praying to God and their patron saint, Don Gregorio, who some feel lives in Old Popo and will give them a signal when it's time to move on. Meanwhile, the bravest are building new homes at the foot of the mountain, without any sign of fear, ignoring the acrid atmosphere. They have the feeling that the Lord and their favorite saint will not let them down. They pray every day to the Lord, to Jesus, and to Don Gregorio, who they feel is one of them. There are all kinds of official evacuation programs, but the villagers of San Pedro aren't interested. They've stood up to Old Popo for 1,200 years, the last time it erupted. They hear now that it's time again, with another millennial approach. But meanwhile, they're sending out their positive vibes as trouble brews elsewhere. While the fabled island empire of Atlantis was grabbing major attention as the millennium approached, the infinitely smaller island of Krakatoa in the Indonesian seas was giving us new insight into what may have happened to Atlantis in a series of volcanic explosions eons ago. Krakatoa was back in the news again, more than 100 years after it was blasted off the map in 1883, in what at the time was the most powerful explosion ever recorded on planet Earth. 3/4 of the island disappeared in a roar that was heard around the world, shaking the island of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean. Thunderous 120-foot tidal waves, stirred up by the blast, killed almost 40,000 people in the coastal towns of Java and Sumatra. Huge tsunamis swept over the beaches of Hawaii and South America and inundated the Philippines. There had never been anything on Earth like it before. Buildings were shaken 3,000 miles away. Tremendous explosions reverberated 2,000 miles away in Australia. The skies, for millions of people, were obscured by clouds of ash and gritty smoke rising 50 miles to block the sun, while masses of pumice, porous volcanic rock, stopped seagoing vessels in their tracks. For many, it seemed like the end of the world. Plant and animal life within hundreds of miles were affected for years. Continuing eruptions made themselves felt. There were panics throughout the world, amid talk of mankind facing extermination for its sins. Talk heard even today among the self-righteous doomsayers, saying Armageddon has arrived with a rumbling Krakatoa ready to blow up again, this time taking our world with it. Detached observers saw comforting signs. Small eruptions, continuing off and on, formed a new island only a few miles from where the greater part of Krakatoa used to be. Some saw retributive significance in this rebirth of an island that had been given up for dead. The new island a few miles from the old was named Anak Krakatoa, the child of Krakatoa. It was heartening, as the millennium approached, to watch a train of human beings climbing the Krakatoa slopes in search of adventure and the past. It was no Atlantis, but it expressed the faith and resolve of man to learn from that past. With the new millennium on the horizon, many of an optimistic turn viewed the revival of the islands, still active, as indicative of the promised resurrection. As recently as 1996, new eruptions of a gentler nature were occurring on Krakatoa, plumes of dark smoke reaching for the sky. The offspring, Anak Krakatoa, was making itself felt, too, doing very well for a baby, with its cinder cone forming in a few weeks and going into action. When you look at what remains of Krakatoa, or what it was, a geologist noted, you have to wonder how anyone got out of Atlantis. Currently, the island authorities invite people from all over to visit Krakatoa's slopes and tread on the ground formed by molten lava thrown up from the fiery crater. It was the same courage and inspired faith in the Lord that motivated these simple people to hang on when sophisticated city dwellers would have been scooting for the nearest ferry. Casey put an erupting Pilei on his active list for the New Age. The Hawaiian Islands, namely its Kilauea volcano, was known to homeowners as Madame Pilei, the volcano goddess. Beginning in 1990 to give up a steady stream of lava ringed with fire consuming all the homes on its path to the sea. Casey warned of Pilei's arrival in a pre-millennial period ending in 1998. But as he pointed out, many times, any disaster could be changed as man harbored thoughts of others besides himself. He evidently felt this spiritual change would take place by the millennium, for he predicted later, despite all the prophecies of doom, a quiet period of gradual change in the Earth's nature with a heightened one-world consciousness. Old Popo seems more representative of a changing millennium, possibly because we have some evidence of its past in its present. There are heroes on every doorstep, people who saw no reason for leaving their homesteads because they felt protected by their God and his saint, Don Gregorio. Jess Stern can't say too much for them. They are hard and tough, honest. They keep their morale high with the deep communal feeling that often develops in a small town that ekes its living out of the soil, bringing them closer to nature and the Creator. They have leaders who fought first of the others, lifelong neighbors, and then themselves. One of these heroes, the hardy, outspoken Jaime Romero, dusting volcanic ashes from his face, was approached as he labored with some workmen on his new concrete-reinforced home at the base of the volcanic mountain. "Why all this building, with a smoking popo liable to blow its stack at any moment?" he was asked. an investment in the future, Jaime Romero responded with a smile. The kind of faith that moves mountains, according to Casey. But, hopefully, not for another millennium, thanks to the sublime confidence of a humble and spiritual people in God Almighty and his ambassador, Don Gregorio, who, some thought, would help the millennium come in. In his lifetime, Edgar Casey paid little attention to the doomsday prophets currently making headlines. Somehow the American public seemed more partial to mindless warnings of its own annihilation than Casey's reassuring forecast. With God's word that the millennial beginning will not be a hotbed of devastation, but the recycling of a spiritual age with a growing consciousness of brotherhood, despite the false prophets Christ warned about. Casey saw the Aquarian Age beginning in the present year, 1998, when he expected his own presence to be felt. Apparently referring to the upsurge in portrayals of his life in film, books, and symposiums, he was asked what the New Age would mean to mankind in its emphasis on the mental and the spiritual, and he replied, "In the outgoing Piscean Age, we had the entrance of God among men, with the birth on earth of Christ. In this age, there was the consciousness of the ability to communicate with the creative forces and the uses of same in a material way. This awareness, in the age of Atlantis, brought the destruction of man through selfishness and the beginning of his journey upwards." Casey was optimistic about the survival of God's world as he knew it. In his portrayal of the millennium change, he constantly saw a reassuring rise in spiritual values in America. As an inveterate Bible reader, he was familiar with the biblical prophets and their foreshadowing of the planet Earth. He was drawn to the books of Daniel, Ezekiel, Isaiah, the prophet of the coming, and Jeremiah, as well as Matthew and revelations out of the New Testament. Nowhere in these passages, he saw, was there any clear-cut prophecy of the end of the world, only an end of the beginning, with the regeneration of man and a God ready to forgive those fallen by the wayside after repenting their sins, in their rejection of the commandments and the Sermon on the Mount. Casey was quick to assure any of the worried world enders that the millennium would slip in on little cat feet. "Concern yourself with the world inside you, and you will have little to concern you in the world outside you." Jeff Stern heard of the heralded end of the world from evangelists preying on the fears of so many told that the earth will go the way of Atlantis, even as they thought Atlantis a myth. There were many doomsdays. The world has been ending almost since it began. In a more rustic America, the Millerites, predecessors of the Adventists, gave away their earthly possessions, donned their ascension robes, and waited ecstatically for the world to stop. It didn't. And the founding father, William Miller, blaming a biblical miscalculation, braced his followers for a second assault on heaven. He died shortly thereafter, a disillusioned and broken man. The world had ended for him, but not for his disenfranchised followers. They started suing for the worldly goods they had given away in a burst of celestial emotion. Every worldwide crisis, every great war, appeared to flush out a flood of biblical interpretations foretelling the end of times. The restoration of Israel as a nation, mirrored by the struggle between good and evil at Armageddon, served to quicken this feeling. But revelations, as Casey saw, did not presage the end. Not in this millennium or the next. Casey did see continuing trouble in the Middle East, with revelations Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. A timely forecast, since Babylon was the historic seat of Iraq's ruler Saddam Hussein, an avowed enemy of freedom-loving democratic nations. His capital, Baghdad, was usually associated with Babylon, in a region that later became Iraq. Like the prophet Jeremiah, Casey saw sporadic warfare in the Middle East, though Israel was not recognized as a nation until 1948, long before Saddam Hussein became the most powerful leader in the Arab world, a constant thorn in the side of the Western world. First, with his incursion into Kuwait, then subsequent defiance about the arsenal of secret weapons he had been building up since his defeat in the Gulf War. The Iraqi president was likened by others, and by himself as well, to Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king who destroyed Jerusalem 500 years before Christ. Saddam speaks of the mother of battles, just as the mother of nations are spoken of in the Bible. But he overlooked in his comparison to an earlier rule of Babylon that Nebuchadnezzar was destroyed by God's will because of his forays against the Israelis of that time.